From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR correspondents around the globe. I'm Douglas Roberts. On the podcast this week, a perilous pilgrimage in Iraq, assessing the war in a tiny part of Afghanistan, the musings of a Russian oil magnate on trial, and the bomb that wasn't dropped 41 years ago. In Iraq this week, some 2 million Shiite pilgrims walked from all over the country to the shrine of Imam Musa Qadim in Baghdad. Other such pilgrimages in Iraq usually take place in the Shiite strongholds of the south. This one became a test of the security services in Baghdad. NPR's Kelly McEvers reports from the Iraqi capital.
This is one of those parts of Baghdad where high concrete blast walls separate everything from everything else. The walls were built to keep Shiites and Sunnis apart during the civil war in 2006 and 2007.
So we're following the trail of pilgrims into a neighborhood called Adamiya. There's secret police, there are army helicopters flying over, there's regular police. This is one of the neighborhoods that was worst off during the sectarian fighting.
Worst off because it was a haven for Sunni insurgents. The problem now is that the road through here is the most direct route for Shiite pilgrims from Sadr City to get to the Qadim Shrine. In the past, the neighborhood was closed to Shiite pilgrims. Then, 2 years ago, a group called the Sons of Iraq joined forces with the American military to combat Sunni insurgents. Since then, things have calmed down. Reporter Ghassan Adnan says even when the neighborhood reopened to pilgrims, it was still considered dangerous for Shiites to walk through a Sunni area.
They had this feeling that it wasn't secure enough, that maybe someone's going to blow up himself, a suicide, or maybe a sniper would be here or there. But right now, no. See, they're more relaxed, sleeping on the ground, giving more water.
Water from cups, bottles, bathtubs, and also fried potatoes, yogurt, and sugared dates. One of these food stalls is set up in front of a house owned by a Sunni man who's provided a hose and access to his courtyard. You could call this a kind of solidarity between Sunnis and Shiites, says Abbas Ruhayf al-Kinani, a volunteer from Sadr City who's manning the tent. But he says it's also a way for the Shiites to offer protection to the Sunni man in case the pilgrims get out of hand.
He's feeling totally safe as long as it's us here and as long as he's opening the front gate for us. So he's feeling totally safe and he's living inside, away from us.
After stopping at the tent, men, women, babies in strollers, and even elderly people on crutches shuffle toward the two golden domes of the Qadim Shrine. Shiites believe making the trip means their prayers will be answered. On this day, more than 1,200 years ago, Imam Musa Qadim is said to have been poisoned by the Sunni caliph. Songs tell how his body was left on a bridge near here that spanned the Tigris River. During this same pilgrimage back in 2005, nearly 1,000 people were killed in a stampede on a newer version of the bridge after rumor spread that a suicide bomber was in the crowd. Pilgrim Riyad Yusuf Jassim says he'll happily walk that bridge today. If he gets hurt, he says, he'll receive even more blessings in heaven.
If something happens, as long as for the sake of religion, I'll be happy. I'll be happy because I'm doing something for God.
Looking around, we see young pilgrims wrapped in white shrouds, a message that they're ready to die. We decide it's time to turn back. Later, after sundown, a suicide bomber killed 24 pilgrims and wounded scores more, and other bombs went off around the city. In all, 54 Shiite pilgrims died this week, and more than 300 were injured. The first, most deadly attack happened on the bridge. Kelly McEvers, NPR News, Baghdad.
A small farming district in southern Afghanistan has become a gauge for assessing progress in the Afghan war. NATO troops, primarily U.S. Marines, and Afghan security forces reclaimed Marja from the Taliban in a short and violent offensive in February. The operation raised hopes that the area could quickly be restored to Afghan government control and serve as a model for operations in Kandahar and other parts of the country. Instead, Marja has seen a resurgence of violence, and the effort to provide meaningful government services is taking longer than expected. NPR's Corey Flintoff embedded with U.S. troops in Marja last month, and he sent this report.
No one really disputes that Marja is a violent place right now. U.S. Marines acknowledge that they're facing almost daily ambushes from Taliban fighters and that roadside bombs are a constant threat. The disagreement is over the meaning of the current level of violence, whether it's an expected stage in restoring the area to government control, or a sign that even a big U.S. and Afghan troop presence isn't enough to provide security and stability or win the trust of the population. At least some local people say the military operation here is failing. NPR's Afghan reporters in Kabul interviewed people in Marja by cell phone because local people may face intimidation from the Taliban if they're seen talking directly with outsiders. Hakyar, a 33-year-old merchant, says the security situation has deteriorated over the past few weeks. He says the Americans are staying closer to their bases because whenever they go out, they face attack by the Taliban. He says the Taliban have threatened to retaliate against anyone who cooperates with the government. Hamid, a 21-year-old farmer, says things have been slightly quieter in his area over the past week or so, but only because the Americans have limited their patrols and are staying in defensive positions. When the Americans do come out, he says, they often get attacked and innocent people are caught in the crossfire. Lieutenant Colonel Brian Christmas says his Marine battalion, the 3-6, has in fact been out in a lot of places where the Taliban didn't expect them.
Today, the Taliban are trying to make a mark because they feel the pressure. We've put forces, we've dedicated them there, forces that they're not used to seeing.
Christmas spoke on what he called a bittersweet day, in which he had attended a memorial for one fallen Marine, then learned that another Marine and an Afghan Army soldier had just been killed. Still, he said, the day had a positive side, an instance in which Taliban fighters ordered local people to shut a popular open-air market and met with resistance.
And people started to close down the shops because they feared for their life. Well, then one of my elders got on the microphone and he said, no, we're not doing it. We're not closing the shops. We're a community. Leave the shops open. And most of them did.
Christmas says that increasingly, local people have shown a willingness to stand up and publicly ally themselves with the Afghan government. U.S. officials in the area say the intense media coverage of Marja points up the violence without putting the struggle in context with other areas in central Helmand province that are now stable after going through less publicized bouts of violence of their own. Scott Dempsey is a U.S. aid official who advised the Afghan district government in Nawa, a small farming town not far from Marja. Allied troops drove the Taliban out of Nawa nearly 8 months before Marja, but Dempsey says it went through its own spasm of insurgent violence after that.
When Nawa was cleared last July, many of the insurgents who were fighting in Nawa were able to flee to Marja, and the malevolent influence of Marja was around until February when Marja was cleared.
Dempsey says the capture of Marja helped relieve pressure on Nawa, which is now stable and relatively prosperous, an indication of what he believes Marja could be given another 6 months or so. Whether Marja will be relevant in another 6 months is another question. The NATO command is focusing on a much bigger task, uprooting Taliban militants from their spiritual home in Kandahar. Commanders say that task has already begun, but it will be more focused on governance and rebuilding, and hopefully less violent than the offensive in Marja. Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
Russian leaders say he's a corporate criminal. Outside observers say he's a victim and a symbol of everything wrong in Russia. They're talking about Mikhail Khodorkovsky. He was once Russia's richest man, an oil tycoon whose wealth and influence caught the eye of Russia's political elite. The question is that what landed him in jail? NPR's David Green has our story.
One thing you can say about Russia's legal system is it's hard to tell who's pulling the strings. It often still feels Kafkaesque. You can't tell if you're on the wrong side of the law or someone else.
I sit in a cage made of bulletproof, slightly tinted glass. The cage muffles the sound, so I see the courtroom more clearly and feel a bit detached. With less background noise, I can concentrate more on people's emotions.
Those are Khodorkovsky's words. We couldn't interview him, but he responded to our written questions, and an actor is reading what he wrote. Each day, the 47-year-old with his buzz cut and tired eyes is led into an isolation chamber behind his attorneys. This is common practice in Russia. Often defendants watch their trials from inside this aquarium, as the chamber's known.
You have to see Russia beyond the window dressing. The Russia where a political opponent can be sent to prison for many years and his property taken from him. You have to see Russia as a country where society views this with indifference, where the elite keeps silent.
Not so long ago, Khodorkovsky was running the Russian oil giant Yukos. He was rich, savvy, and shrewd, owning a long list of enemies. And he was politically active, funding several opposition parties. In 2003, he was arrested on charges of tax evasion, and he spent the last few years in a Siberian prison camp. Now, in his second trial, Khodorkovsky and a business partner are accused of stealing billions of dollars and nearly 350 million tons of oil from their company. A conviction could mean 22 more years in jail.
The Kremlin says Russia is a country of great opportunity, but my trial demonstrates that it is also a country of great risks.
His fate, many believe, is in the hands of one man, Vladimir Putin. He was Russia's president in 2003 when Khodorkovsky was arrested. Many believe Khodorkovsky simply became too rich, too influential, and to Putin, too dangerous. Putin, now prime minister, rarely speaks of Khodorkovsky in public, and he doesn't seem happy when he's asked about it. This was in December. Putin went on to explain that Yukos under Khodorkovsky was never a model of good behavior. For one thing, the company's security agency, Putin said, was accused of engaging in contract killing. These crimes are proven, Putin said. We should not forget about that. Khodorkovsky himself was never implicated in those events. As for the defendant's current trial, Putin said the court will act according to law. If Putin is really in charge of all this, what's the thinking?
This is a question that is impossible to answer.
Political analyst Masha Lipman from the Carnegie Moscow Center said with this trial and all else, Putin loves keeping his intentions a mystery.
Putting to shame all the guessers, whatever the decision is.
One recent decision caught people by surprise. Two men, one current and one former official in Putin's government, got permission to testify. And rather than support the government's case, they helped Khodorkovsky, saying if he stole that much oil, they would have known about it. A turning point? Lipman believes not. She said Putin may have been hoping for a few days to halt the negative publicity around the trial.
This one twist, this one turn, adds a grain of propriety to it without having a crucial impact.
The trial has dragged on for months. Each day, a new twist, a new character. Recently, Kevin Dagis, an American expert in accounting and business valuation, showed up. He had offered expert testimony in more than 25 trials in the U.S., and he was never turned away by a court until now. The Russian judge said Dagis wasn't familiar enough with Russian corporate law. Out on the street, Dagis said he had hoped to testify about Yukos bank records that appear to account for the money Khodorkovsky's accused of stealing.
What they're being charged with is nothing more than the movement of funds from one pocket to the other in perhaps what is a many-pocketed pair of jeans, but still all within the same family.
Critics of this trial see the charges as vague at best, and they say Khodorkovsky's experience is proof that Russia's legal system is corrupt.
I was really upset when I got into that room.
Mary Louise Beck, a member of the German parliament, has traveled several times to Moscow to sit in.
To throw people in jail because you are afraid that they might be of political danger to you is authoritarian. Russia has to come back to the rule of law. Russia is a member of the Council of Europe. You have very firm principles there, and Russia doesn't go along with it.
The defendant has embraced any outside support. He has a PR machine getting his message out, and he's written op-eds in newspapers like the Washington Post. None of which has impressed Putin's allies. Sergei Abeltsev is a member of the Russian Duma, or lower house of parliament. When Khodorkovsky's criticism of the Russian legal system showed up in a Russian newspaper, Abeltsev filed a complaint saying the paper broke a law against extremism. For me, Khodorkovsky's an ordinary criminal serving his sentence, Abeltsev said in an interview. I don't think he's shown any remorse. Apparently, he's embittered and calling for the overthrow of our constitutional system. What Khodorkovsky has called for in his writings is a Russia free of corruption and with a transparent legal system. Guilty or not, Khodorkovsky has developed a message, and he's capturing attention from inside prison in a way he never did as a free man. Khodorkovsky's 76-year-old mother, Marina, often comes to the trial. She remembers asking when her son became successful if he feared going to jail. Mother, he said to me, these are new times. We have democracy and everything will be different. She also said her son was determined not to flee Russia when he had the chance. I asked him, do you regret that you stayed? He thought for some time and said, no, I don't regret. Now I'm able, with honesty, to look into people's eyes, my children's eyes. If I had fled, they would have said, he's a thief. That's why he ran away. As much time as Khodorkovsky spends poring over legal documents in the courtroom, he and his mother often make eye contact.
Her support is important to me and heartwarming. I know she approves of what I'm doing. I have a real mix of emotions when I see my children in the courtroom, especially Ilya and Gleb. I'm happy to see them, but I know that at their age, they need their father with them, not as an image through a glass.
David Green, NPR News, Moscow.
Coming up, what Nixon and Kissinger considered doing to North Korea.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Douglas Roberts. North Korea has been in the news recently with the torpedo sinking of a South Korean naval ship that left 46 sailors dead. That was in March, and so far neither South Korea nor the United States has figured out how to respond beyond a statement of concern from the UN Security Council. Such was the case, too, in 1969, when North Korean fighter jets shot down an American spy plane. Then President Nixon and his National Security Advisor, Henry Kissinger, considered a whole range of military responses, up to the possible use of nuclear weapons, this according to newly disclosed documents. But in the end, they, too, decided to do nothing. NPR's Mike Schuster has a report.
The incident occurred on April 15, 1969. An American EC-121 reconnaissance plane, carrying a full crew, took off from a base in Japan and did what it had done dozens of times before. It flew over international waters, gathering signals, radio communications, and other intelligence. This time, though, fighter jets from North Korea intercepted the American plane and shot it down, killing all 31 Americans on board. In the immediate hours after the attack, and for the next few months, President Nixon and his advisors struggled to come up with a response, according to Robert Wampler, a historian who works for the National Security Archive, a project of George Washington University.
The U.S. did not have a very good menu of options when this happened, which sort of constrained them in their ability to pick and choose amongst something that would work and also contain the situation.
Wampler recently posted 16 documents on the website of the National Security Archive, among some 1,700 that he has been studying. They illustrate vividly just how difficult it was for Nixon to respond to the North Korean attack in such a way that would not spark a wider war. 2 months after the attack, the documents show, the option of using nuclear weapons was presented to the president.
The military produced the options, ratcheting up the level of military force all the way to all-out war and to using nuclear weapons. But constantly you find the military saying, but the risks probably still outweigh the potential gains.
These documents do not address what Nixon and Kissinger considered doing in the immediate hours after the attack. By the time that the nuclear option arose, Nixon was considering what his choices might be in the next provocation from North Korea. But a former U.S. fighter pilot has come forward with the story about a nuclear alert just hours after the attack. Bruce Charles was on temporary duty that day at Punsan Air Force Base in South Korea. He was on standard alert as part of the Single Integrated Operational Plan, or SIOP, the plan for nuclear war with the Soviet Union. His assigned target was an airstrip in North Korea. Early that afternoon, his commanding officer called him into his office, Charles says.
When I got to see the colonel, it was very simple. He described the shooting down of the EC-121 about 100 miles at sea, and that he had a message, which he showed me at that time, saying to prepare to strike my target.
Charles then rechecked his F-4 fighter jet and the weapon it was carrying. He says it was a B-61 nuclear bomb with a yield of about 330 kilotons. Not the biggest bomb in the U.S. nuclear arsenal, but quite large, more than 20 times the size of the bomb dropped over Hiroshima. Then there were several hours of waiting, Charles says, and the order came to stand down.
The order to stand down was just about dusk, and it was not a certainty. The colonel said, "It looks like, from the messages I'm getting, we will not do this today. I do not know about tomorrow."
Charles's story could not be independently confirmed, but not long after the North Korean attack, the New York Times, citing sources in the Nixon administration, reported that there was discussion of a nuclear attack against North Korea. Morton Halperin worked at that time in the National Security Council. He believes President Nixon did decide to retaliate against North Korea, but says Halperin he has no knowledge that a nuclear strike was considered.
Nixon had made a decision that we would retaliate by bombing the air base from which we believed the planes had come to shoot down the EC-121. And he had ordered an aircraft carrier to move close enough to be able to carry out the bombing.
2 days after the attack, though, Nixon held a press conference, and what he said led many in Congress to conclude he was not opting for retaliation. He was praised widely for this restraint, Halperin recalls, and then decided against a military response. The documents posted by the National Security Archive suggest that for half a century, American presidents have had the same problem with North Korea, says Dan Snyder of the Asia-Pacific Research Center at Stanford.
The danger of a wider war tends to trump whatever benefit you think might come from punishing your enemy here with a retaliatory strike.
That's precisely the dilemma the Obama administration has been struggling with since March, when a North Korean submarine sank the South Korean ship Cheonan with a single torpedo. Mike Schuster, NPR News.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Douglas Roberts.